Show Me the Way, episode 23, The CEO's M&A. This episode, we talk with Alan Schlosshauer of 2717 Group. All right, Alan, you'll have to explain what that is when we get there. But we're going to talk to Alan about his experience in the M&A space, because I've worked with this guy before, and I like how he handles things. And he has, unlike some of our other speakers, boiled it down to three key indicators. Nobody has done this. You got to listen to this. We got a new program concept for your consideration. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast by Spencer Fain, LLP. The podcast is about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Before we dive into today's captivating discussion, for any of you podcast listeners out there, I have a feeling you'll be interested in the upcoming BEI National Exit Planning Conference taking place this August in one of my favorite spots of the world, Denver, Colorado. And to top it off, I will be speaking along with an esteemed panel of top-notch M&A advisors, investment bankers, and financial advisors. Together, we will delve into the current landscape and latest trends we are seeing in the M&A marketplace. If you are eager to be part of this conversation, please mark your calendars and make sure to join us at BEI National Exit Planning Conference this August. Details are available at BEI.com. And with that, let's shift our focus back to the discussion at hand. Joining me today on today's show is Alan Schlosshauer. Alan will share his experience and insight in his role as an owner of a group of individuals assisting buyers in the acquisition of companies. And he's going to boil down his thoughts to three key areas for our discussion. Now, you guys know I'm going to be all over the board. We're going to have a lot of conversation, but I'm excited that he's put it down to three key indicators. This is a nuanced podcast. So let's get into it. Alan, give us a little bit of your background and your early business experience. Let's start with the beginning. Everybody wants to know where you come from, because they can relate to you. Or if they don't know where you come from, they can't relate to you. But let's talk a little bit about where you were born and raised.
Well, that's good. I am a Missouri boy. I'm born and raised in a little town called Boonville, Missouri. So right there on I-70, and grew up in, you know, just an agricultural community, and grew up working with farmers and working on farms, and grew up in a large family. There were six kids. So, I was number five. So I had to learn how to fight my way through some things or survive.
Which says a lot. So you went to, did you go to school in Missouri? Did you go to Mizzou? Where'd you go?
Yeah, there was, does it count that I walked on the campus of Mizzou? No, I did not go to Mizzou. I actually did start my college career out in Missouri, but I finished in the great state of Texas at Texas A&M.
Oh, good for you. What did you graduate in? What was your degree?
Graduated in accounting. That's my background. Really, it just, you know, in accounting, it went right to school, or right out of school, went right into accounting work for a large corporation in downtown Houston. And that's kind of where I got my start with accounting.
Got it. You evolved out of Houston. Tell us about the evolution from that job to what you're doing now. And then share with us what 2717 Group's all about, please.
That's a great question. You know, I started in construction, you know, moving out of the kind of the corporate world or out of the big industry world and moved into construction. And I started right out in acquisitions. I was director of acquisitions for a small publicly traded company that was going across the country buying companies. And so
I did not know that. That's why I like you so much, because I have the similar background. I apologize.
Yes, I didn't know that. Yes. Okay. So I was director of acquisitions for a company called Comfort Systems. And we were going across the country buying companies. And I had, what was fun about that is that, you know, I had to get up to speed, not really on accounting. I knew that. I had to get up to speed on construction and, you know, what their business model was, how they keep score, what their processes was. And I didn't jump out on job sites. I wouldn't have known what I was doing, but you know, you could say it was like drinking from a fire hose, but really it was like a year long steady downpour of rain. I mean, it was a baptism a little bit by fire there, learning that and learning what, you know, what to look for in a company and how that gets valued and what's important, what isn't. And so really what happened out of that, and so from that role, we did acquisitions for about a 2.5 year period. We did about a little over 100 acquisitions. I mean, they ranged in all kinds of, yes. And I got to participate in 80 of those.
Oh,
but that was a fun time. So I transitioned from that. We stopped doing acquisitions probably at the end of 1999, 2000. And I transitioned into an operational role. And so it was just a natural, seamless transfer because I got to go from working on acquisitions to working with these companies that we bought on best practices and performance improvement and process improvement. So I learned a lot working with some really good people out there who took me by the hand and said, you know, this is construction. This is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. Come, you know, let's go walk on a job site, you know, so you know what you're doing or know what you're looking at. It's just a fantastic experience from that. So that was very good. And so from that, and really, I took that experience and I was there for about 8.5 years. And what I really liked about that is it really gave me a great foundation. I go, I really don't want to do anything else. I want to work with companies on acquisitions and I want to work with, you know, them on strategy and performance improvement. Because that's all we had. We were a publicly traded company. We had to drive performance and, you know, Wall Street expected those numbers and we had to work with these companies to kind of really boost those things, you know, where we could. So 27:17 is a proverb. It's a biblical proverb. It's iron sharpens iron. So one man sharpens another. And so this company really is about sharpening those companies, regardless of, you know, what you're working on. Either it's on the acquisition side, you know, either looking at an acquisition or responding to an acquisition inquiry on, and also on the strategy side, helping these companies decide or plan out where they're going to go and how they're going to get there.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is what's unique. I brought other people in the M&A experience on board, sell side, buy side advisors. This is a guy that can tell you the experiences of going out and buying an entity and watching people sell. But then what do we do to get it up and running? And generally speaking, beyond M&As, to his point of iron sharpening iron, I'm going to have to show you the shirt. I've got a shirt that says iron sharpening iron. Strange that this comes up today, but how to make it as effective and efficient, because in many respects, there is one way to build a company, right? To create as much income from the owners. And there's another way to build it so it can be sold. They don't have to be necessarily exclusive of each other, but it's really two separate tracks with some overlap. So this is going to be fun. So let's get to the big three. Your first big three, ladies and gentlemen, this is a bell cow we got to remember. Prime time readiness. Okay, I've never heard that anywhere. What does that mean?
You know, I always go back to this not ready for prime time, or Saturday Night Live years ago had that not ready for prime time players, you know. And, you know, in my experience and even working with companies today, some of them are just not ready for prime time. They're not ready for an acquisition, you know. And so they're getting blindsided. You know, we've had a decade of free or cheap money out there.
Yes.
And it has just stirred up all kinds of acquisition activity, which is great for business. But, you know, owners are getting inundated with emails and phone calls, either from companies that want to buy them or M&A advisors going, hey, I represent somebody, or all kinds of things. And it's just, it's a daily experience for some of them because they forwarded some of their emails to me. And I know it's crazy. But what I realize is some of those guys aren't ready to respond to that. And so here's kind of what I tell them. I mean, like, you know, here's some do's and don'ts, but let's just start out with, you know, on a personal level, you really need to ask yourself, am I ready to even entertain this thought of selling? I mean, you know, I wasn't planning on this. It's not, you know, or yeah, maybe you were, but it just came across the bow and go, how do I respond? What do I do here?
I get these as well. What I do, and it would ask for your take. I use some software programs and I go through an early assessment to try to figure out, number one, where they're at, to assist them in determining, number two, is it time to sell? Because more often than not, because somebody shows up, it doesn't mean that it's time to sell. It's just you've been caught, for lack of a better term, sometimes flat-footed. It just caught you by surprise. And then what do I do?
Yeah, I think that's That's exactly right. You know, and my counsel to owners, you know, as I've worked with them and they've got these things and they'll forward it to me and I go, here's the thing. I think, you know, respond to it. Just say, hey, thank you. I really wasn't on my radar screen right now. I'm really flattered by the fact that you reached out to me. I'll keep your information. So, you know, if the trajectory of my business changes, you know, at any time, then, you know, I'll be glad to give you a call back. And the reason I say to do that is not to just go ahead and entertain that. It just like ice the kicker a little bit. Okay. Just take a step back, take a deep breath, park that idea for a while, wait till you get home at night and just start thinking about it or wait till the weekend. And then it gives you time to process that information and just respond or not respond and just go, do I want to think about it now or not? And I'm glad you do that assessment, Dave, because I think that is so critical to an owner just to have some type of framework to walk through to go, where am I? Where's my head?
Exactly. And to your point, and I learned this from someone else that gave this idea to me this week, and I think it's excellent. He has a list of about 20 questions that he will have his seller clients send to buyers to find out if they're real. And depending on how they answer the question, you know, determines whether or not there's going to be another conversation in the first instance, because I'm afraid we may be slipping back into a time period from about 2009 to 2012-13, where we're going to see leveraged deals again. I'm not saying that all cash deals are gone, but there is a pullback with private equity groups in particular. Multiples are changing and there's going to be more of a carry back. And I got a feeling there's going to be some people sneaking in again, fully leveraged deals, which is, you know, not where we want to be, but great advice, good insight.
Well, and I think that just to your point on that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think when you're doing that, you know, a buyer will call you up. And here's some things I just encourage people, just don't do these things. But let me preface it by saying you need to do your own due diligence on that buyer. And I like the fact you go, you know, do these guys, you got to, can they transact? Because they have the wherewithal. Who are they? Where do they come from? You know, I tell them, ask, do these guys have any experience in your industry? Have they bought companies in your industry? Do they even know what they're looking at?
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, frankly, they may not qualify to do business with you, frankly. So I think you can, you know, for our listeners, I think you can go to a guy like Alan and say, Alan, put together the 20 questions I ought to ask. Okay. Because maybe there's something there, but it could be coal dust. It may not even be coal. I don't know. And I'm not sure they can turn it into a diamond.
One thing, you know, before you do anything, and this is when owners do this, it makes me squirm because they're kind of hurting themselves a little bit. Don't send them a set of financials, even if they ask for it. And don't offer any information about your company other than, hey, you know, my grandfather started this 35 years ago, or, you know, I'm third generation. You can talk about those things and talk about your market, but really, it really isn't any of their business. And buyers, you know, I know this, they'll fish for, hey, what's your revenue? What's your profit? That's not really to be shared at this point. Because you want, as Dave says, you don't even know if they can transact, if they've got the ability to do that. So I just said, don't offer any information. What I do tell them to do is, okay, let's qualify this buyer. And let's go. Okay. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, tell me the background. Who's behind this? Do you all have cash? How do you do deals? And then this is the one thing. Tell me what you're looking for. What are you looking for in terms of revenue? What are you looking for in terms of profitability? What really makes your eyes kind of, you know, go turn your head a little bit when you look at a company and tell me about that. And that way, what you're not offering any information, but you are sizing up real quick whether your company fits with it or not.
And the other thing is, you and I would both tell them, just be very generic, because until they sign a confidentiality or a non-disclosure, we ain't giving them anything, because I don't know what they're going to do with it.
Well, that's the thing. You don't really know whether they're going to do anything with it. And I know owners, they're so flattered or flabbergasted or sometimes distracted by getting a phone call like this that they'll, yeah, well, let me just zip that off to you here, you know, because they're kind of curious. I mean, what would somebody offer for my business?
Right. But more than anything else.
And more than anything else. Exactly. That's right. But you really gotta pre-qualify this, you know, and as you know, there's two different types of buyers. There's strategic buyers, like big companies like I worked for years ago, and that are out there buying companies. And then there's financial buyers like private equity, as you mentioned. that, you know, and both of them have two different types of focus. You know, strategic buyers, you know, are thinking about, hey, we want to enter this market, or we need this capability and we need to add this to our portfolio. You know, financial buyers, and not to kind of limit that in that thinking, but they really like certainty of earnings. They right. like recurring revenue. They like things that they can count on. But all of them really, you know, they want to know what they're buying there. And is it worth talking further about that? So they'll try to get it as much information first. But I think the thing about that before becoming completely transparent, as Dave said, get a confidentiality agreement signed or a non-disclosure agreement, and then start talking about financial information.
I agree with you. What other thoughts under this section we entitle Prime Time Readiness? I love the title. Of course, I went to Colorado, so we have Coach Prime out there. So maybe that's what's attracting mine.
I didn't even know they called him Coach Prime. I guess now I understand Prime Time, but yes.
Yep.
That's wonderful. I love that. But I think if you look at that, here's what not to kind of back up, but let me back up just a second for as far as Prime Time. This is something that it's easy to tell an owner group, and most of them will tell you, yes, you're right, we should do this. Do your own pre-due diligence. Act as if you're going to sell your company. Go through the process yourself without even having anybody on the line, and go through that and go, okay, what works inside this business? What do we need to tweak? What do we need to work on? And this does a couple things for you. It's a really good thing. One, it's going to give you more options. Because you work on some things, you tweak your business, you improve that performance, you may not want to sell, or you may want to sell, but you've put yourself in a better position to do that. And really what you're trying to do at the end of the day is avoid that, what I call the retrading circus.
Thank you.
So that conversation, if you're a financial sucker, we'll talk about this stuff later on, but you know, a group comes in to do due diligence, and you know, and they look at that, and you're going to get this phone call, goes a little bit like this. Hey, we've kind of concluded our preliminary due diligence on this. You know, it looks good, but we've got a couple issues, and it doesn't look like we're going to be able to offer as much as we thought we're going to be offer. So we're going to have to adjust our price by 10 or 20%. And that's just a conversation you don't want to get into. And I've, you know, worked with ownership groups on that. And, you know, how do you respond with that? And it's just, but if you do the work ahead of time, and work on your business, and you prepare it for that process, you're going to avoid that conversation. I mean, at least you're going to reduce the risk or mitigate the risk of having that conversation with a buyer. You want to make sure your ducks are in a row.
Well, and to this one specific point, you want everything lined up so it's easy for them to understand, and you want to identify where there may be challenges early on. Because to your point, if they have to discover it, one of two things is going to happen. One, they think you're hiding something, which will really freak them out. And then we have a different kind of issue, depending on how severe it is. But at a minimum, they're going to reprice every time. And so I say to people that number one number that they give you is the best possible offer, and you ain't getting it. Okay, I'm just telling you, unless you're unusual. So at least know your business as well as the buyer will know it.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's the thing, because, you know, I was talking about a scenario there where really you've already signed an LOI. But and let me mention just real quick, and this is, Dave, I know you're really good about coaching clients on this. And I think the thing about this is before you sign that LOI to say, you know, okay, we've kind of come to terms, you need to ask yourself a question like, what do I really want here? What's important to me? What's the three or four things or five things that are very important to me in selling this business? And it could be in terms of price. It could be in terms of, do I want to keep working or do I want to retire? Right. You know, what's going to happen to my employees? You know, what are you going to do with this building? What are those things that are really important to you? And it may be taxes or, you know, understand what those things are before you sign that LOI, because once you sign that LOI, your ability to negotiate goes down, 85% or something. Right. You know, it goes way down. So get that clear in your head before you do that. But I think, you know, once that LOI is signed, I mean, that's where the fun begins, as I say, and that's where the roller coaster ride begins. And it's hard to explain that to an owner because the process starts out so slow.
Yes.
You know, and it's just like that first little climb at a roller coaster, and they're going up that steep hill. and it's all slow and we're all waving, you know, and you haven't got to that first big dive.
Yes.
It's a big crescendo. You can explain that to an owner in, you know, 15 ways to Sunday, but they don't know it. They don't really appreciate it until you're going, oh, you weren't kidding.
No, I'm not making this stuff up.
That's right.
You've hit on so many things that my mind is racing about all the stuff that I talk to people about, all the things I talk about along these lines. But you keep going because you've hit on some key issues and resolved them for me. I also talk in terms of deal fatigue, that in every transaction, there's going to come a point where you're exhausted. And the danger is when you're at exhaustion, what do you do? And some people will compromise just to get it over with. Some will walk away. But to your point, I think you're demonstrating it is a roller coaster. And the question is, can we make this the equivalent of, you know, walking, you know, the western part of Kansas where it's as flat as it could be, right? I don't want the Rocky Mountain of negotiations. I want Western Kansas, flat and straight.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That's the role of an outside advisor and really an attorney, just to go, hey, we're here to kind of run ahead of you and kind of run interference and try to smooth this out as much as possible. But it's going to be a little bit of up and down. And I was listening to a podcast the other day, and I've heard this before, and I know you've heard this. I mean, this guy tells clients, listen, this deal's going to die three times before we close it.
Good advice. Like,
well, yeah, that's right. And I think that's exactly right. And here's the thing about that, you know, and I want to talk a little bit about just quickly about due diligence and about that roller coaster ride. You know, you sign that LOI and all of a sudden the buyer comes in and provides you with a list. And sometimes that list is 4 or 5 pages and sometimes it's 20 pages of information they want.
Yes.
And you got to put it together. And it's just what I call, always call due diligence. Like from a buy side, you know, this is for construction. You go, it's an exercise in value engineering. As you touched on, we're going to value engineer this deal.
Right.
We're going to make it a little more affordable. But that's what due diligence is. And they send you that information. And here's why they do this. And this is a big thing. I always like saying this because there's two questions that a buyer gets. One of them, they don't mind answering. So if they're outside CPA or somebody inside the company goes, okay, well, tell me what we paid for this thing. How much did we pay? Kind of what was the structure? And the other, most CEOs they don't mind answering that question. The one question they don't want to answer is this. It goes like this. A CFO will come up to them or a board member and will go, now tell me again, why did we buy that company?
But that's usually about 3 years later, right?
Well, yeah, sometimes, sometimes not, Dave. Sometimes not. Having been on the receiving end of that question, and had to squirm a little bit, that's, you know, they're afraid of that question. Trust me, when they're doing due diligence and they're asking you for all that information, that's in their back of head. The other thing that's in the back of their head is this statistic. And this statistic came from Harvard Business Review 8 to 10 years ago, or a little bit longer. And it says this, 70 to 90% of all transactions, M&A transactions fail. I don't mean they fail to close, but they fail. So they're, you know, you think about the big one like AOL and Time Warner. That shouldn't have happened. You can name a bunch of other, Microsoft bought Nokia or something like that because they thought they were going to get in the phone business. I mean, those things fail, but you know, that's not true. That wasn't my experience on the, you know, buying privately held companies, but that statistic is in the back of their head when they're doing due diligence. And it may feel like you guys are really asking for a lot of information here, but there's a big fear that, hey, what did I miss? Didn't identify.
You hit the nail on the head. And, you know, along the same lines, what I would tell people, I'm not a fan of mergers in for a variety of reasons, because usually it is similar sized companies or reasonably sized company. And my first concern is nobody's really merging with anybody. A merger is really a legal concept. Somebody's buying somebody. So who is going to be the lead dog on the sled at the end of the day? And the second issue is usually a merger or a combination like you talk about are two big companies. So your chances of success have dropped dramatically. You're far better off getting smaller entities that you, what we call tuck-ins, and bringing them into the company, because you could win big, but it may not be a big win. But if you lose, it's not going to be a big loss. You can figure out how to deal with it. I'm working with some folks right now. We're going to be buying, you know, pieces of a business, and for their size, it's perfect, because, you know, given their size and the company they're going after, they're doing it in a reasonable way. I'm not a fan of mergers overall based on experience. Having said that, you and I can go out and find 100 mergers that worked out well. But
that's right. That's right.
Let's talk about now attractiveness, which you refer to as skeletons and other deal killing and price adjustment areas. I want to get into, you know, I see skeletons, for some reason I think dinosaurs, so hopefully we're not going down that road.
No. Well, I look at that and I, you know, you think about why do transactions fall apart? And again, this goes back to kind of coaching sellers a little bit on being prepared, but here's the things that really, in no particular order of importance here, but you know, when you look at this, there are some things that really cause some issues. And the first issue is what it comes down to is called strategy. And really it goes like this. As a buyer, you want to know that these guys have a kind of a clear idea that they know how they make money. They know how, you know, they know where their competitive advantage is. They've got an idea where this company is going to, or, you know, going in the future. They realize as part of their strategy, hey, we need to bring in a partner here. And they're yes. really clear on that. And just as an antidote there, I was talking with a friend of mine. We're just talking about deals and stuff like that. And he was talking about a large transaction. Private equity group came in, sitting down with a, you know, several hundred million dollar company, and just started talking with the management group about, you know, tell me a little bit about kind of where you see this business going. What's your key areas for expansion? What do you think, you know, well, how can we scale this? And the CEO just had no answer for him. He just had no idea. I mean, because really, he was just looking like, "Hey, we've got our arms around what we've got our arms around right now. I don't know where we're going. We're just trying to manage what we've got." And unfortunately, that buyer ended up walking away.
Right.
It's just the wrong answer. So when I say strategy, I mean have a clear idea, be able to articulate the value of your business in terms of, "Hey, here's our competitive advantage. This is why we win. This is why we beat out competition in these areas. And these are the key things." I think the second thing, and this is actually, and I've got this listed second, but you know, this is actually the biggest thing that causes deals to fall apart. And that's just financials. The financials are in poor shape. They're not, you know, they're not accurate. That's what I have. I say this. I have three A's when I look at a business. Okay. When I get a set of financials in and I'm looking at it, I'm kind of thumbing through it. I'm looking at margins. I'm looking at the mix of work. If it has that information on there, but really what I'm looking for is the three A's. And first is accuracy. Are they accurate? I mean, you know, can I rely on these somewhat, or do they add up? You know, when I compare this with other information, that's the first A. The second A is, are they acceptable? And what I mean by that, are they recorded according to GAAP or generally accepted accounting principles? And do they follow GAAP accounting? Are they doing that? Or are these, as I like to call, Chef Boyardee accounting? Is it like where they're cooking the books and you can't rely on any of that? You gotta watch that. And the third A, you know, I say is, are they audited? And audit kind of gives me a greater comfort, you know, if they've got that. It just means that somebody has taken in, the outside CPA firm has gone in there and provided some assurance that these financials are accurate. And I think it's really funny. And the reason I say that is, I remember doing a big deal years ago, you know, out east, and we had a large company we're trying to buy, and it's getting close to year end. We want to close this deal by year end, and we're trying to get financial information. Well, they only did financials twice a year. This is a larger company. Yes. So we've got
once a month, and I'm a small guy.
That's right. We've got financials from June. Like, okay, that's nice. Okay, so let's talk about getting something in here. And literally, I mean, it was a scramble. And so we kind of had to eventually just abandon our idea of closing that by year end. And it took another month and a half to do it. I mean, we got it done. we got some assurance, but it was, I remember talking with our due diligence lead on this, and he was going, what do I do?
Yeah.
I said, well, don't make anything up.
Yeah. Yeah. It, among other things. Yeah.
Among other things.
Well, you're right. I mean, that, I think where people get lost is that doesn't mean the deal dies. It just makes it a hell of a lot harder.
It makes it harder. And here's the other thing. And I'm talking about these things that cause price adjustments today because they really do. Because if you can't rely on that set of financials, you're going, well, wait a minute. I don't know that my offer is going to hold here. I may need to adjust this. The third area, this is the one that it really does. A lot of owners don't think about this too much because they've got these great relationships, and that's customer concentration. And that just comes down to having too many eggs in a basket. And I mean by that, you've got one or two customers that make up 50, 60% of your business. And buyers look at that and go, well, wait a minute. That's a risk. If I still want to do this deal, I can do it, but it's a risk and I've got to price that in. I've got to price that risk into my offer. Now that you've provided me that information, I'm like, I don't know, like my offer is going to stay. And that can really cause an issue. We bought a company in the Midwest. It had a large client in lots of locations across the U.S. I bet 1500 locations. Great client. Good for service work. We loved it. We went in there with our eyes wide open. That was 60% of their business. Mm-hmm. So we documented that in our due diligence. We provided that information to the board. Well, this is a great company. It's solid, but here's this risk item. And here, you know, and so, you know, long story short of that, about 3 years later, that big retail customer went bankrupt. And that's why you that's the risk. That's the things that cause people to adjust prices because, or even walk away because that risk that can happen. If that customer gets.
Yeah. You nailed it. I mean, I've had a deal here. I've had a few deals where people walked away simply because the concentration is so heavy. You know, if you're up, I don't know what's the right percentage. If you're 50 to 80%, I don't know what to tell you in one customer. I just, you know, if you're more than 20%, I think people get excited. So
yes, they do.
And I just, you know, I've seen deals crash for that. I've seen deals crash to your earlier point because of the financials. They don't trust the numbers.
Right. That's right. I think, you know, another item, just moving through that, just that customer concentration is what I call owner concentration or key man concentration. And what that is that, you know, we run into a lot years ago because it's just, you got an owner that is just the business. If he gets hit by the milk truck tomorrow or he doesn't come in to work, it's just going to fall apart. He holds the relationships and it may not be the owner. It may be a key man, a key business development guy or somebody just holds all those relationships. If something happens to him, what happens to that business? And so you've got to look at that. And these are things that, you know, during due diligence, you kind of discover this and go, well, wait a minute. Here's a risk item for us. I mean, this may cause us to want to kind of rethink our strategy here and rethink this deal. And that's a big one.
You know, to your point on that, well, you covered it. You're smoking it because smoking in this case is not a literal term. you're spot on because they will ask now if the owner leaves, who controls the customers of the client? If that key man isn't there and they got to go out and hire somebody, that changes the deal again.
Yep. That's right. And you got to be able to mitigate that risk. And so as a buyer, you know, when we look at those things, you go, okay, so is there a way for us to kind of start planting or hiring people to kind of help mitigate that risk? Does it make sense for us to do that, to take that risk on? And can we move this business in a direction where we're kind of, you know, we're doing our risk assessment here. We're making some smart decisions for the future. I think the other thing, there's a couple more things there, just, well, about two or three more things. But one thing I like to call this, you know, Dave, is relatives, friends, and you know, other people and other people who need a new home.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Please. No, go ahead. Cause I got, go ahead.
Oh my gosh. Well, you just, you know, it's good that we can laugh about these things now, Dave, but you know, you see this, you look at a business and their wife's on the payroll, their uncle's on the payroll, which is, there's nothing wrong with that if they're adding value or they're actually fulfilling a role there and they're a key part of that deal. But really what you find is, you know, they've been provided a home for a long time and, you know, you might want to kind of, you know, as part of your pre-due diligence process, you know, find them a place to go if you're thinking about selling, because those are things that are just kind of hard to deal with. They're tough conversations,
yeah.
Especially if it involves a patriarch or somebody who found the business who, you know, who's not necessarily, you know, really have any active role in the business going forward.
Well, to your point, I've actually had one where he had his second home in the business, right? So, I mean, literally. So you look through and you look for those things and you see, especially in the kind of business we work with in construction, every wife seems to be in every business, or every spouse, I should say, you know, and they probably can figure out that they may not be necessary, but, you know, they can kind of figure from the person's position and the salary whether or not they're going to be a long-term player once the acquisition takes place.
Well, that's right. I had a client last year. The buyer came in. He just said, you're going to have to fire your wife. And he laughed because he knew that was going to happen. And
yeah.
She was just there part-time anyway. He goes, well, that conversation is going to go well.
And there was probably a financial buyer too. They handled it really well. You got to fire your wife. The strategic buyer probably handled it a little differently because probably his wife is working in his business.
That's exactly right.
So.
Oh my gosh. I think, you know, the last thing, you know, that kind of throws things off, just a couple things there that throw things off deals or cause them to kind of die. You know, it's just surprises. And sometimes it can be, and sometimes you can't plan for this or just pops up your finances. You have a bad month right in the middle of due diligence. You got another month goes by and it just goes off the rails and something happens, or you have a customer cancel a contract and that's got that throws it up, or you get a lawsuit or a key employee leaves. All those things happen and it can throw that whole deal or put it on pause.
Or something comes up out of the clear blue. How are you dealing with COVID?
Oh, yes.
Right. What is force majeure? I mean, I'm not saying they're taking their eye off the business, but, you know, they're going to ask you, how have you dealt with COVID? How have you dealt with it? What did you do? Did you get any money? Because one of the things they're going through right now, and you see it probably as much as I do, is they'll put in the COVID money as an asset. I don't think so. Or book it to earnings. It's like, no, that's a problem. But you're right. I mean, how did they deal with these problems and who dealt with it? Good call. And you're right. It may be something simple to your point, but it could be like in the last couple of weeks, I've had people calling because of the banking issue. What do I do?
Well, you know, to that point, Dave, I can't pass this up because you brought up the banking issue. You know, I heard this investment banker said, you know, when the Fed taps on the brakes, somebody's going to go through the windshield.
That's a good one.
You just don't know who's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. It is the law of unintended consequences.
Yes, it is. It's but that happens, you know. And I think, you know, these are just things, and Dave, you and I have seen a lot just there that just can cause a deal to pause or cause the economics of the deal to change. And again, it's just the more that sellers understand these things, hey, these are what buyers are looking for. And they don't sleep at night until that deal's done. And even after it's done, they're still waiting for that first month or first quarter financials because they're nervous, because they're afraid that, you know, they don't want to get that question, right?
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
Thinking, yeah. And we bought this company because ellipses, right?
Yes. That's good. That's good.
This next section you want to talk about, I love, because it's one of the things. In fact, when I talk to people, I talk about the gap, and you call it the reality gap. So I'm going to learn something here. That's the good news, because it's a tough conversation. Please lead us.
Well, I think part of that, we'll both learn something here today, because, you know, I'm always reminding myself of this. You know, I think that the tough part just in the front end of anything is you have an owner who has a certain reality, and that reality is based on the fact that they've poured their life into this. This is the biggest asset. It's the biggest decision they may make ever, you know, in their life. And it's from a business standpoint. And they have this thing in their head, like, I'm not going to sell this thing for less than, you know, 10 million or 50 million. I'm just not, or I'm going to get 10 times earnings. And that's all great. I just listened to them. I'm like, that's, so tell me, and sometimes I just talk with them. Well, tell me how you got there. What made you say that? And how do you value that in your head? And then you got to go back to reality. Go, okay. Well, here's how a buyer looks at this thing. Okay. And they're looking at a lot of different things. I mean, on the front end, it's financials and it's customers and, you know, mix of services or business mix and, you know, depth of management staff and strategy and all these things. So they don't really approach it the same way. So these, you get two parties who don't look at value the same way. And that creates some interesting dynamics, as you well know. But really, I tell an owner, you know, value really just comes down. You can have a certain value in your head, but it really only comes down to what a competent buyer is willing to pay. And you've got to know, does that make sense for me?
Well, there's two things that I usually look at this point. It depends on what the cycle is, but I always want to start with a valuation just to set kind of a benchmark. You know, how realistic is it? And I don't know, is it your belief that there are some valuation people who are good on the sell side and some on the buy side, or do you look at it that way?
No, I don't look at it that way. Cause ultimately we don't meet in the middle, but I mean, it is going to come down to, you know, what that buyer or group of buyers will offer for that business. But, you know, and I, you know, in talking to sellers, I do fuel this a little bit just because I'm curious before I even look at their financials. I go, do you have a number in mind? I mean, like, what's your number? Is there some number? And just so, you know, and I'm not asking them that so they'll negotiate against themselves, but here's, I'm really curious if, you know, is there something that it's really important to you or some value that's really important to you before we start too far down this road?
And to your point, is that something that most sellers determine by themselves?
That's a loaded question. No, Dave, that you know that does not happen. They don't determine it by themselves. They determine that by what they've read and who they've talked to.
Yes.
And what Larry down the street got for his business. And that's
all of that.
All of that. Yes.
Yep. It doesn't make it wrong. It's just, you get a lot of information and, you know, we both know there's three ways to value it, essentially replacement cost, or if you're going to come out of it green, you know, what would it cost? What does the market say? And, you know, that has some value, but not really so much. And then there's just the valuations. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, buyers look at these things with valuations, and it's really, I mean, it's based on a lot of different things, but primarily in today's market, it's based off some multiple of earnings or EBITDA, but that's how most buyers will price that. There's a lot that goes into that because they're looking at their balance sheets and they're looking at their assets and they're looking at their earning streams and what they've done, but it comes down to usually some multiple.
Right.
And this is where, of course, your conversations, hey, the owner doesn't determine that on instead. He'll know, well, that guy over there got 7x earnings for his business. Well, he's not the same type of business, or he's got some different things going on. These businesses are different. And when a buyer provides a multiple and says, we're going to offer 4x, implicitly what that says is, and that's just the inverse of that is 1/4. I'm expecting a 25% return on this investment. That's the implied return that I want for that business. They offer you 3x, that's a 33% return. And really what they don't tell you when they're pricing that with that multiple, it is, this is the number of years that I think that I'm going to be able to maintain this level of earnings with this company. And, you know, and you can hear about these big multiples, 10, 12 times earnings, and there's good solid economic reasons for that. There's good business reasons for doing that. But that's how buyers look at that. I need a certain return. If I'm going to put my money out there, I need this return on this business.
Right. Well, and I know of a company that their multiple is 20x. I struggle with this very large company, publicly traded. I just struggle with it. But, you know, again, to your point, you know, at the end of the day, when it's all said and done. If you got a motivated buyer, he'll write checks. And I think going forward, there's still way more money than there are sellers. But that doesn't mean they're just going to empty the wallet. In the words of now the NFL, you know, you may not get the bag that you would have gotten a few years ago, so to speak.
Yes.
but there's a lot of money out there. I read an article, I'm trying to remember who said it, but the nut of it was that there is going to be a lot of money out there, but the person questioned once all of the baby boomers, okay, start punching out, is there going to be a lack of money because they're taking it off the table? I don't know where they're going to put it, but, you know, going to more conservative investments. Are we going to see the downsizing of private equity groups just based upon population and numbers and that we have now? And I think he was talking about 2033, that people are pulling back in on investing in businesses. Interesting question. I haven't followed up with anybody on that. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I've been giving that a lot of thought lately, just in terms of the economy slowing down and you know, flirting with recession. But, you know, and to your point, there are only so many good companies out there to buy, and there's probably a lot that need to be worked on. But what is private equity going to do?
Right.
And I think they're going to be sitting there holding a lot of cash, as they're sitting on several trillion, you know, single digit trillions of cash right now looking for a home. I think that's going to cause some things to, some dynamics there to change. I really do think that, you know, private equity has to invest that money.
Or they got to give it back.
Yeah. Give it back. They have to invest it or give it back. And that they don't want to do that. But at the end of the day, if it can't find a home, what do you do? A strategic buyer doesn't go. He doesn't sit there with that cash and go, okay, well, we can't find anything to buy. Great. Let's go expand our operations. Let's go move into this, you know, let's go build a building. Let's go do these things. They can find a home for it. It's hard for private equity to do the same thing.
Right. You absolutely nailed it. I don't think anybody needs to get worried about it. If you've got a good business, there's somebody out there that wants it. And I think there's some new developments going on. I'm hearing about ESOPs buying other ESOP companies. You know, that's a fairly new phenomenon, at least in my experience. I'm seeing more offshore companies coming in with money. We're still the best bet when it comes to business. In the world, there's some other good places, but we're still the best bet. Then you throw on the reshoring. I think I posted something on, like, last year, there four almost a half a million jobs came back to the United States from overseas. That's not a huge number, but it's still a number. So there's plenty of opportunities.
Well, there certainly will be. We won't run out opportunities for that in terms of doing transactions. But I think the players will change a little bit. The dynamics of that will change a little bit over time. But that's what makes this a fun place to play.
Oh, yeah.
As far as business.
Yeah. How do you deal with people who say, what do you think is the multiple on my business? Because I get asked that a lot. I'm sure that you do too.
Well, I like, here's what I do. And I use this Pepperdine study that comes out once a year, because it's just something I can go, this is printed. These guys did research. They researched investment bankers and lenders and all kinds of things. And I go to that Pepperdine study. So I said, let's go look at construction here. And here's the range of multiples. And I go, these are averages. Keep this in mind.
Yeah.
Some things are going to be up. Some things are low. And that way I don't have to go, you know, I don't go have to go back to an owner going, well, you told us that was going to be a 5 and they only offer 3.5. I'm like, you know, that happens. But I'm just saying you can expect this kind of range, but don't count on the upper end. And don't be surprised if the offer comes in at the lower end. That's okay.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
So give me kind of your 3 parting thoughts.
Well, I think that's good. This is an acquisition is it's a big decision for anybody. It's a big decision for a buyer because it represents a risk. It's a huge decision for a seller because it's their life's work. And it's one of the most important decisions they make. But I think, you know, when I look at that, on both sides of the transaction, I tell both sides the same thing. there's two things. One is preparation is key here.
Right.
And what buyers, I tell them, I say, listen, you, especially construction buyers, I go, look, you would not start a construction project without pre-planning that job, without having a set of drawings and, you know, understand that whole pre-plan about being clear on what you want to buy and where you want to buy and the size of company you want to buy, understanding that and understand what it takes to get a company, you know, integrated into your business. That's not an easy process. So preparation is important. On the sell side, preparation is important, as we've talked about earlier. Get your business ready. Put yourself in shape to sell. And that, you go, well, where do I start? Well, ask somebody a question. Ask, you know, what is the value of buying? We've talked about some of those things today, you know, about what's important and what can make your company more valuable just by addressing some of these issues that cause deals to go off. So my first word there, parting thought, is be prepared. Whatever you can do, be prepared, and that will prepare you for the journey called M&A. The second thing is, and I say the second, but it really is first. I had this phrase I like to tell people. I like strategy comes first. In a business, before you turn on the lights and before you go out on a job site, strategy is the key to that. So for a buyer, if you're going to do M&A, it should align with your strategy of your business in the direction you're heading. If you don't have that down, M&A is not going to work for you. So strategy comes first. Understand what your competitive advantage is. Understand how you're going to win in the marketplace. And that may involve M&A. It may not, but have that down. On the sell side, strategy comes first this way. Strategy means, as far as M&A are concerned, it's the natural progression of your business. You've come to a fork in the road strategically, and you're going, we can go down this road and continue to do this by ourselves, or we can bring somebody else in who can help us leapfrog our competition. And does it make sense to do that? So having a clear strategy on the front end makes this thing go so much more smoothly.
Would you say that 100% of business owners sell their business? That is, sooner or later, they get out of their, they sell their stock one way or the other, or ownership. Well, no, nobody's immortal is what I'm trying to say. Everybody has to go through the process.
And unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't happen the way that you would want it to happen. But right. Yes, it is going to go a certain way. It is going to get disposed of one way or another.
Yeah. And when I say everybody goes through the process, maybe it's an insider sale to family or employees, or it could be to the third party. But 100% of business owners are going through that process. There's no question.
Yes, they are.
Great insights. I learned some things. I like the windshield analogy, although that is kind of bloody, so to speak. But I like that at the end of the day. But I learned a lot. I want to thank you, Alan, for appearing on the show. I know that there are going to be a lot of people that would want more of your information. Very easy to talk to you. How do they find you on the face of the earth? Can you give us your information, location, email, phone number? How do they run you down if they need your help?
Well, great question. Here's that. So website 2717group.com. That's the easiest. And then email Alan, A-L-A-N, at 2717group, or by phone 480-800-4107.
Excellent. Alan, thanks for joining us today. If you, my listeners, are in search of assistance, go to davidsider.com and schedule a consultation. Also, subscribe to the show if you would, please. Rate it and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It's great. Thank you, Alan. Thanks, everybody. And we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. This podcast is provided for educational purposes and does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with an attorney on their distinct circumstances.